So Nile Rodgers hears David Bowie playing him this.
Let's dance.
And he turns it into this. That's why Bowie hired him for the Let's Dance record. We're going to get into that. He wanted a hit. He hired the hit maker. Nile Rodgers has so many hits, it's just silly. All the way up to Get Lucky with Daft Punk fairly recently. Decades of hits. This was really interesting to hear him reconstruct it. This is our second episode of Rewind. Full episode coming next week with a brand new interview. You're going to love that. Always new stuff coming. And this Rewind series is fun because now that there's 170-something episodes, it's cool to go back and re-listen to some. Or in case you missed it, like you do not want to miss this moment where Nile discusses meeting David Bowie and becoming his producer for what is probably his biggest album and kind of a big comeback record for Nile Rodgers as well. And then meeting a guy from Texas named Stevie Ray Vaughan before the world knew who he was. Bowie brought him in, as you know, of course, after seeing him play Montreux. So there's good stuff in there about all of that. And then there's also the demo, of course, which you're going to hear in there where Nile has a bunch of A-list musicians playing a demo of Let's Dance, and it's kind of more of a funk version. Good stuff. Hope you all are doing great. I've been touring a lot with Jefferson Starship all over the place. Hope to see ya. It's funny, I stopped in a music store, Mom's Music in Louisville, Kentucky. We were playing there, and it was just so much fun. They have all kinds of cool stuff. Vintage guitars all the way up to brand new stuff. I even couldn't help myself. I left with a Charvel, what is this, a San Dimas Pro Mod import, but it's all like fully relicked, cool orange paint with a Floyd. I needed a shred guitar. The only one I have is like a Frankenstein that's a Van Halen kind of style. So I needed another locking trim guitar. Actually, I also have a Strat too, but this was a nice addition to the arsenal. Plays so great. It just wanted to come home with me, like that kitten or that puppy that just jumps out at you and makes friends with you at the animal shelter. Well, I went to Mom's Guitar Shelter, if you will, in Louisville and snagged this thing. Too much fun. Go out there and support your indie music shops. And we're headed to Tulsa this weekend if anyone wants to stop by. Saturday night show in the Tulsa area. Jefferson Starship, baby. We also just announced Deep Purple again. We're hitting the road with them again. I'm so psyched. If you heard the Simon McBride episode, that was quite an adventure. And they're so good. All right, let's rewind the tape and check out this amazing moment where guitar player to guitar player, Nile Rodgers tells you how he created one of the biggest rock hit dance songs of all time. Keep it alive to you, 95, folks, and we'll see you next week with a killer brand new interview. Oh, and yeah, just a quick reminder that if you want to hear the full Nile Rodgers episode, which is episode 125, or any of the others, they're all still up in the archive, which is right there, wherever you get your podcast. Just scroll back. Go deep.
Okay, so David had said to me before we got to Switzerland that we made a plan. He said, "Now, you know, I want you to do a hit album." And I was like, going, wow, a hit album? Like, that was what I was running away from, because prior to working with David, I had had lots of hit albums, at least for a guy like me. I mean, I was still pretty much a journeyman when David had come into my life, but still, this is following, as you said, Good Times, I Want Your Love, Everybody Dance, 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 We Are Family, He's the Greatest Dancer. I mean, single after single, hit after hit. And even what we would call a minor hit, Norma Jean was still a gold record moving to platinum. So we, you know, every record we had done had all sold over a million, if not two or three or four or five or six. So when David came into my life, he said that he wanted a hit album. So at that point, I felt that I was charged with that responsibility and I was not going to let him down. But then one morning he walks into my bedroom and he says, "You know, Nile, darling, I think this is a hit." And he plays something to this effect. He goes,
"Let's dance."
Right? He's doing that. And I went, wow. Whoa. I thought he was like trying to play a trick on me to see if I was like a sycophant who would go like, oh, Bowie, that's really great, David. Yeah. So I actually called a couple of mutual friends and said, you know, would David do this? Would he play a trick on me? Because he told me like he wanted hits, and now he's playing what sounds like a folk song to me. Not that folk songs aren't hits, but we were now moving into the 80s, into the new romantic era, and stuff was grooving, and Frankie Goes to Hollywood and all those kinds of records would come out. So his friends assured me that he wasn't playing a trick on me. So David and I, when we first met, we never really talked about pop music. All we talked about was jazz. And I knew that he had a deep knowledge of jazz, a really deep knowledge. So I knew that he understood the vernacular. So I asked him, I said, hey, David, do you mind if I do an arrangement on that song? And he said, oh, sure. And that was cool. That's all I needed. So I then started working on it. And I did the moving voice thing, and but I did it a little differently. I went... And then, so instead of playing the second chord as an F, what I did was I played it sort of like an F. It was an F, really, but I put it there. So I went, and I kept the third in the bass. But that wasn't cool, so then I went, and I said, oh my God, I did a minor 13 chord. That was like really cool. And then I went to the F. And I was like, holy cow, I got a progression. So I went. And then that was still sounding dark. So I moved it up to B flat and went. But that was still too dark. So then I said, hell, let me put the whole thing up an octave. And I went. And then played the minor 13 here. And then I put the six chord. So the end result.
Beautiful.
So what the benefit of that, so not only did we have hip jazz chords, but we had super smooth voice leading, which basically was just. Yeah. Right?
Of course, you add the bass to it. It's so incredibly funky with huge drum sound. But the other thing is you've got a wonderful sort of ping pong delay. And to put on our guitar geek's hat here, I assume you probably added that in post at the desk maybe? Or
well,
what is that delay?
So here's what happened, man. This is so funny. So David and I were in the lounge. And Bob Clearmountain, the way that we would do our sessions every day, I got to put this in context. So R&B records, let's just call it black records, black people's records, we had much smaller budgets than the rock bands would have. So typically we would make our records in 8-hour sessions in a day. So we would just book 8 hours and then leave. And then every day we'd have to start again. And, you know, we didn't get to block out the studio and just like have it for a month or two or three or four. We never did that. I never blocked out a studio until I did the Duran Duran album, Notorious. Every other record I made, including Like a Virgin, everything was 8-hour sessions. And it was all done like black records. And we finished the albums in like a couple of weeks. Let's Dance was done in 17 days, start to finish. Everything, mix, Stevie Ray Vaughan solos, David's vocals, background, everything, horn arrangements. I did all that stuff.
Yep.
And it was done in 17 days. So David and I would typically sit in the lounge and we'd discuss what we were doing that day while Bob Clearmount is setting up to get the sound to record. So we just happened to walk in when he was getting the delay times for the different instruments that he was going to put delays on just to have a nice effect. But when we walked in, he was doing them all at the same time on the drums. And we went, what the hell is that? And it was like, whoa, that's amazing. Keep that. So at that point, I had been sort of running away from the whole disco sucks thing. So if you hear the original demo of Let's Dance, which I think is online somewhere now, you can hear what I really did, the first arrangement of it, where I'm actually playing funky. But because I was trying to run away from the chucking sound, and I heard these great delays, I realized that if I just play doing all upstrokes, which gave it a different thing, so it really accentuated the voice leading, and Bob's delays would kick in, and I go and it winds up going. You know what I mean? And the delays are just, bouncing back and forth. And when David and I heard that, we just flipped out and we put it on the guitar and it was just magic. It was just one of those things that we had no idea. Bob wasn't even expecting to do that. We just walked in at that moment and heard it and said, hey, do it on this. And that's the wonderful life of making records, because it's all about the accidents that happen, that wonderful moment where the person plays the wrong note and you go, whoa, what was that? And we put it in the arrangement.
Yep. And then you're like, here you go, Dave, there's your hit. Boom.
Well, I knew it was a hit the funky way, because if you listen to the demo, that was me trying to convince David that my arrangement of it was the way that it should be, instead of the dong 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 dong, instead of doing it that way. So if you listen to the arrangement, you hear how happy David was. He was just so open-minded at that point, because we were doing the demo with some jazz musicians in Switzerland, and we were at Queen's studio, a studio called Mountain. And he just was happy being around really sophisticated people who could read the charts, and you know, he just loved that vibe. So he knew something was going to happen, but he didn't know what was going to happen. And trust me, neither did I. I wrote it and I had a good idea of what the chart sounded like because I could play it, but I didn't know if the jazz guys would groove the right way. I didn't know what would happen. I didn't even know these guys' names. So we get, and when you hear this demo of the way that I originally did it, and you hear somebody scream and go, "Woo! That's me, not David." Even though David is singing, I'm the one who screams, because the groove worked within like four bars. I realized that, uh-oh, now this is right. And you can hear David singing all along the way, and finally by the end it starts to really sound like the Let's Dance that we know, and he's doing those riffs that he would then incorporate into the song that we would wind up doing once we got back to New York.
That's it. Got it. Got it.
Now, was Stevie Ray Vaughan tripping when he's like, what am I doing here with this British glam rock superstar and this funk producer? I use the word funk to describe any music that has groove, whether it's hard rock or R&B. And here I am from Texas playing in New York. What was it like when he walked in the room?
So this was really one of the greatest moments of a first meet. So my first meeting with Bowie was incredible, and it led to us doing Let's Dance. My first meeting with Stevie Ray Vaughan was like, David, why don't we just call Albert King? Because I'd never heard of Stevie Ray Vaughan, right? I knew Jimmy Vaughan from the Fabulous Thunderbirds, but I didn't know he had a brother, right? I had no idea. So when Stevie showed up, and he just, the first thing he plays on Let's Dance is just one single note, one B flat. Like, so he just goes, and that's it. And I'm like, what? And it sounded so Albert King-like. I kept thinking, well, David, if you want a hit, wouldn't it be cooler if we had Albert King? And so that was the first meeting. But then he starts to get into it and he develops it a little more. And then he just keeps playing and it's just brilliant. But still, I'm not like all blown away. But then we do China Girl. And then I go, okay, now I see why you called this guy. And all the while, Stevie now is in the company of me and all my musicians, because on that album, there's no one on that record that David hired. Like, he didn't know Omar Hakim, he didn't know Tony Thompson, he doesn't know Carmine Rojas, he doesn't know Rob Sabino, they're all my guys. So the only person that he knew was Stevie Ray Vaughan, so he couldn't wait in a strange way for Stevie to get there, because that was the one comrade that he sort of could have. Because these were just all my guys doing what I have them do. But what was really awesome about Stevie is that I guess he was into the whole camaraderie of bands, right? He was into that. So he came in, he saw how close we all were, and he did the coolest thing ever. He had a shipment of barbecue ribs shipped up from Austin, Texas, from a joint called Sam's Barbecue. Now, this is before FedEx and all that kind of stuff, so I don't even know how he pulled this off. But when the barbecue ribs arrived, they were, I guess, sort of packed in hot ice or something like that. But they also came with a calendar of Sam's Barbecue, and it had the serving, the women who worked at Sam's Barbecue, and one of them was named Irma. And somehow there was a little picture of me as a baby floating around, and they cut my little face out and stuck it on Irma's head. And from that point on, everybody called me Nile Irma. So I was Nile Irma to Stevie. I was Nile Irma to everybody on the date. And it formed a bond that lasted up until he passed away, you know, because, you know, I did the final record with him.
No, guitar is safe.